This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 20th of December. An attack on the crowded Christmas market in Magdeburg in Germany, as the US Congress prepared to vote on a bill without which the federal government could be forced to stop spending, why are Democrats accusing Elon Musk of undermining a previous cross-party deal? Just 37% of those regarded by the NHS in England as most vulnerable to getting flu have been vaccinated to date. Why? And what could that mean for hospitals? Why the fall of President Assad is generating fears about a resurgence of the group that called itself Islamic State in Syria. And we mark the longest night of the year in the way Persian culture has done for thousands of years, with poetry. A Saudi Arabian-born man is under arrest after a car was driven at speed into a crowded Christmas market in the city of Magdeburg in the west of Germany this evening. Two people are known to have died, 68 are confirmed injured. Because of the gravity of some of their injuries, that death toll is expected to rise. News broadcasts showed dozens of ambulances at the scene after the incident, which took place at around 7 o'clock local time. Because of the scale of what the Saxony-Anhalt state government called an attack, hospitals were on standby to receive the injured well beyond Magdeburg itself. In the past few minutes, Lars Frumelov from the local public broadcaster MDR told the World Tonight he witnessed the aftermath of what happened.
Everywhere were ambulances, there were police, there were a lot of fire workers, and this was a real chaotic situation. We saw blood on the floor with people sitting beside and having these golden and silver foils around them. And we saw many doctors and so on, and trying to keep people warm and help them with their injuries. There are many emergencies. There is a helicopter. They bring people to the hospitals in Magdeburg and around the city, and also many ambulance mobiles parked in a big line at nearby the Christmas market. It's a big shock. It's a big shock for every people here in Magdeburg and also for every person in Saxony-Anhalt.
Well, live to our correspondent in Berlin now, Damien McGuinness. Damien, had there been any indication that an incident of this kind could happen?
Well, we had, of course, a terrible attack in 2016 here in Berlin at a Christmas market when an Islamist extremist drove a truck into a Christmas market here, and that killed 12 people. And large amounts of people were injured, and that horrified the nation. And since then, there has been massive security around every single Christmas market, and it's been something every year, really. People have debated here, they've wondered, well, will this happen again? How do we prevent it happening while at the same time keeping things open and free? And I think there has been a sense over the last few years, as the global situation has become more difficult and more heated, and there have been regular reports from security officials here over the years that Islamist extremism is still an issue potentially, and that security is an issue in general, that I don't think people will be, they'll be shocked but not necessarily surprised, let's put it that way, because I think this has been a debate for a long time.
What has been confirmed tonight from Magdeburg?
We know that at least two people have been killed, one of them a small child, and it's thought that as many as 70 people might have been injured, 15 of them seriously. So we're talking about large numbers of people who are involved in what officials are describing as an attack. The suspected perpetrator has been arrested. He is described as a doctor who's been living for around 20 years in the region, originally from Saudi Arabia. But we don't know any links, or he does not have any known links to Islamist extremism so far. That's what officials are saying. And he doesn't have any sort of police record. So it's very unclear why he might have done this. It does seem to be a deliberate act, I think, given the numbers involved. But so far, officials are not clear about what the motive might be. So I think until we know more about the motive, I think it's very difficult to say what the broader implications of this attack might be, apart from, of course, the horror for those people involved.
Damian McGuinness in Berlin, thanks very much. Let's speak to the German counterterrorism expert, Professor Peter Neumann. Professor Neumann, thanks very much for being with us. As Damian was saying, there had already been extensive security measures as a precaution against German markets. What is being said from your sources this evening?
Well, they've clearly failed. And your correspondent said it quite correctly. Christmas markets are a topic that are talked about every year in Germany as a potential target for terrorist attacks since 2016. 8 years and one day ago, we had the attack in Berlin. And this time again, on top of this, of course, it's a fact that this year we've had a number of attempted and executed terrorist attacks in Germany, to the extent that many people were fearful that the frequency of Islamist attempted and executed Islamist attacks is increasing very significantly in Germany. So, yes, the profile of the attacker, a 50-year-old man, is quite surprising and unusual. The fact that Germany is a target of Islamist terrorism is not a surprise.
Peter, can you still hear me? We've lost the line, I
yes.
think. Oh, you can. Forgive me.
Yes.
Let me ask you a supplementary question to that. Germany's about to embark on an election campaign. We've already had a political debate between the parties on the extent of domestic security issues and law and order issues. How worried will they be that this could get caught up in party politics rather than be treated as a kind of an issue for the whole country?
Well, absolutely. And I think this will probably dominate at least the coming weeks of the political debate in Germany. We have elections on the 23rd of February. So that's almost exactly 2 months away. So a lot of space in this election will probably be taken up by this issue. We've seen, of course, that over the past months, the AfD, a far-right party, has been increasing. They've been heavily critical of migration. They think that too many Muslims are in the country. And this will, of course, be utilized by them, even though the probable attacker, the suspected attacker, is not a refugee. A lot of this debate in Germany is about the refugees that have come to the country since 2015. This man has been in Germany for nearly 20 years, so he's not technically someone who should be caught up in this debate, but this will probably happen.
Peter Neumann, German security expert, talking to us live about that attack in Magdeburg this evening. We will, of course, keep you updated if those casualty figures change during the course of the programme and if we get any other further details. To the United States now, where Congress is shortly to vote on new legislation designed to avert a partial shutdown of the US federal government. Funding is due to lapse at midnight tonight unless Republicans and Democrats can agree on a way forward. It's the third time this week there's been an attempt at agreement. Two earlier attempts failed. The first had been negotiated between Democrats and Republicans. That is, until President-elect Donald Trump and his advisor Elon Musk intervened. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat, sought to exploit Republican divisions by suggesting it was Mr. Musk, not Donald Trump, who was really pulling the party's strings.
They write the bill. They post the bill. They agreed on a bill.
They signed it.
And you know what? They got scared because President Musk told them. President Musk said, don't do it. Don't do it. Shut the government down.
Well, a couple of hours ago, the House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican, spoke briefly to reporters about his level of confidence of getting a vote tonight.
We have a unified Republican conference. There is a unanimous agreement in the room that we need to move forward. I will not telegraph to you the specific details of that yet because I've got a couple of things I got to wrap up in a few moments upstairs, but I expect that we will be proceeding forward. We will not have a government shutdown and we will meet our obligations.
Right. Let's go live now to Washington, to Katie Edmondson, congressional correspondent at The New York Times, who's there at the U.S. Capitol. Can you give us the latest, Katie?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. We are watching lawmakers debate this latest stopgap spending bill that Speaker Johnson unveiled on the House floor as we speak. And right now it's an open question whether there's enough support to be able to push that across the finish line over to the Senate. Speaker Johnson is using a special procedure here in the House to fast track this bill for a vote. And so in order for this measure to pass, it needs 2/3 of all lawmakers present and voting to support it. And right now on the House floor, we're seeing a pair of senior Democrats, including Congresswoman DeLauro, who your listeners yep. just heard from, say that they're in fact very unhappy that Republicans reneged on the deal that yep. Speaker Johnson struck with them earlier, and that they're not prepared to support it. And so it's really an open question what happens.
Just to be clear about what it means when we talk about a partial shutdown, it doesn't mean everything stops at midnight local time.
Well, look, I think people have been talking about a partial shutdown because that's what we saw in 2018 when then President Trump forced one. Congress has not passed any spending bills yet. So if they are not able to pass any sort of funding measure before midnight tonight, we would be talking about a full shutdown right. of the government. Now, of course, there are necessary services that continue even in the case of a full shutdown. Members of the military, for example, continue their responsibilities. They do so on furlough or without pay. And so those are the types of problems that are created. But certainly critical services do continue.
Katie, stay with us if you can. Let's bring in Professor Wendy Schiller, who is at Brown University in the United States. Professor Schiller, let's just be clear about this. A lot of this is to do with the way government has always been done in the US system. House representatives are elected every 2 years, so they have to deliver stuff for their local voters. And that stuff is often what's agreed in these last minute deals.
Yes, exactly. And the Senate represents states, which are typically larger, not always. And the House is the whole country and much smaller. And they have different needs. So some people want to make sure farmers get paid. Some people want to make sure that we build more submarines. You can imagine all of the different trades that go into these bills. Typically, 30 years ago, there were 12 different bills and they took 6 months to pass. Now there's one big one. And presidents are usually handed a very large package with not a lot of negotiation, and they don't like it, and they want to exert their authority. In this case, we have a president-elect who wants to exert his authority, and it needs to pass the House and the Senate. Constitutionally, it has to start in the House and then go to the Senate, and we have a Democratic-controlled Senate right now and a Republican House. So people are asking, if the House passes this bill, the government stays open. No, not at all. It still has to go to the Senate, which is why the Democrats have power in the House right now, even though they're in the minority party. They are essentially speaking for the Senate when they say we will say yes or we will say no.
And what about the role of Elon Musk in all of this? Why is it causing such stress among Republicans?
Well, I find it fascinating that Democrats, who aren't the world's best party at messaging, as we saw in 2024, have decided that Musk is a real button to push for Donald Trump by referring to him as President Musk, as if he's a co-president. And we know Donald Trump likes the spotlight. So they're trying to drive a wedge between Donald Trump and Elon Musk because they've already seen the way that Elon Musk can blow up their own negotiations. And I think to a lot of them, they fear that kind of influence over President Trump.
Let me go back to Katie, who is there at the New York Times, Katie Edmondson on Capitol Hill. Katie, what's your reading? We've got about 30 seconds or so left. What's your reading of what's likely to happen? Do you think the Republicans will vote together this time?
Well, we know that there are at least going to be a few Republicans who oppose this legislation because they're saying it simply continues spending levels at untenable levels. Really, all eyes here are on Democrats and what they decide to do. They are going to be the ones that are able to push this bill over the finish line or to derail it from going over to the Senate. And we're going to see that vote play out in just a few minutes here.
Well, we will keep our listeners updated. Katie, I know that they will find your reporting on the New York Times website. For now, thank you both very much for joining us on The World Tonight. Now, 5 years ago, Iraq and Syria were both threatened by the group that called itself Islamic State, an unprecedented alliance brought together rival groups and even countries to suppress them. the Americans, the British, the Russians, and many others playing a part. After the fall of the Assad regime in Syria, could IS re-emerge? US military has carried out 12 airstrikes in recent days, targeted at what it says are adherents of Islamic State. Today it said it had killed its leader in Syria. Aaron Zellin, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute think tank, maps IS activity and told me about the latest US airstrike.
This individual named Abu Yusuf or Mahmoud, he was believed to be the leader of the Islamic State within Syria specifically, not the top caliphate position, but for their operations within Syria. So it's a big get, definitely.
And what about the scale of U.S. strikes against Islamic State? Has the tempo increased in recent days?
Well, since the fall of the Assad regime, we've seen the U.S. increase its airstrikes within central Syria, which had been previously controlled by the Assad regime, in part because the Islamic State's terrorism campaign in Syria was worse in those areas than in the areas that the U.S. had previously been only operating in the east with its partners in the Syrian Democratic Forces.
So in terms of the actual operation at the moment, it's fair to say it's ongoing, it's active. And is that because there is simply the concern about the Assad regime collapsing and leaving a vacuum? Or is it because there were already signs of Islamic State activity on the ground?
It's a little bit of both. In 2024, the Islamic State had three times as many attacks as they did last year. So it's the first time that there's been a negative trend line related to this since they lost territory in 2019. It's still nowhere near as much as it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. But it is worrying that that happened. And then in light of the regime falling, there's a gap potentially, especially in the central desert area of Syria, that the U.S. wants to try and stop anything from growing before it does.
The north of Syria has been an area in particular where Turkey has taken a lot of interest because it's right on its border. What about the situation there? Is there a potential for Islamic State to become more active?
It's possible that the Islamic State might take advantage of the situation whereby the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces take resources away from the fight against ISIS because they have to deal with the Turkish proxy group, the Syrian National Army, fighting them. And therefore, ISIS might try and break people out of prison that the SDF is currently controlling. And there are 10,000 male ISIS members in there, and that would be a disaster scenario.
In terms of then the presence of IS on the ground, what do we know about how active they are?
Besides the different attacks that they continue to do against different forces, whether it is the SDF or whether it had previously been the Assad regime and its allies, it's also been involved in some form of shadow governance in eastern Syria as well, where they'll take over areas for a short while or at night and try and implement sort of their rule again or extort people for money.
There is a sense in which they are still a threat to individual parts of Syria and to people on the ground, but they're not yet a threat to Syria as a country, anything like the threat that they posed back in 2019.
That's correct. It's nothing like it was 5 or 10 years ago, but it still remains an issue. It hasn't gone completely away, even though it hasn't been a top news story anymore. But they've continued to try and rebuild themselves. And no doubt, just like any scenario where there's a vacuum, they'll try and take advantage of what's been happening in Syria the last couple of weeks. And the hope is that the U.S. and its partners can blunt any of that, and so it doesn't happen.
Aaron Zellin from the Washington Institute. Well, John Allen is a retired four-star general in the U.S. Army. He coordinated international efforts against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. General Allen, thank you very much for being with us once again on The World Tonight. What do you make of what the U.S. government is doing now? Because there have been reports of troop numbers in Syria actually increasing. And this, of course, will be ahead of a changeover to administration with President-elect Trump, who said he doesn't want to get involved in Syria.
Well, we shouldn't be surprised at all that the U.S. has increased those numbers. This is a moment when there has been the creation of a power vacuum. ISIS will always take advantage of a power vacuum if it's given the opportunity. It's a malignant, vicious organization. And the U.S. has got long experience in dealing with this organization and increasing the troop numbers, increasing our strikes against ISIS targets. That's completely logical at this particular moment to contain this potential growth to fill these vacuums.
A lot of the existing Islamic State prisoners or active fighters who are picked up and detained, they are in areas that at the moment are controlled by Kurdish opposition groups, opposition to the Assad government.
That's correct.
Is that going to get complicated? Because there's a suggestion that, for example, the Turkish government, which has its own proxies in Syria, won't want those people any longer to be involved.
Well, the president of Turkey, Erdogan, has already said that it's his strategic goal to eliminate ultimately the SDF and to have foreign forces depart, meaning us as well, unpressurizing or depressurizing ISIS in that area by removing the SDF is no good for the future of Syria and certainly no good for the internal security of Turkey over the long term. Again, ISIS knows no borders. It is a vicious group. And if the SDF is removed from being the principal defeat mechanism and the principal source of pressure on ISIS, it's not going to be good for anyone, and Turkey in particular.
The current government, if one could call it that, those who've taken control in Damascus now have been successful in controlling the cities. But Syria's a big country, and presumably there are areas outside of the major cities and conurbations where it's possible for groups like Islamic State to operate with comparative freedom.
Well, that is correct. And the good news is I think that the SDF has actually reached out to the new government in Damascus with the idea of beginning to find a power-sharing future and a road of potential cooperation going forward. ISIS has been where it is in the concentration that it has because it's sort of in the coolest spot in the room. And now that the regime in Damascus has collapsed, the Russians aren't bombing them any longer, we can see that there probably will be increased movement by ISIS to consolidate its forces and to increase the numbers of attacks.
General John Allen, who was in charge of the Global Alliance Against IS in Iraq and Syria. Thank you very much for being with us on The World Tonight. Now here, the number of people in hospital in England with flu jumped 41% in a week and continues to be more than four times higher than the number hospitalised this time last year. Among those regarded as at high risk from the flu, which includes elderly people and those whose immune system is compromised, just 37% have been vaccinated. Yesterday was the last day eligible groups could book a free flu vaccine online, but it is still possible to get one if you go to a pharmacy. Why then have vaccination rates been so low this year? Claire Bryant is Professor of Innate Immunity at Cambridge University. Professor Bryant, welcome to the programme. It's the million-dollar question, but it's probably a very difficult question to answer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite a challenging question to answer. And there's potentially multiple causes for that. And I think there's some elegant work done earlier this year actually investigating some of these causes. And there seems probably the commonest risk problem is that people really do not necessarily have a perception that A, flu is nasty, and it can be really nasty. In a normal, fit and healthy person, you fight it off, and it's unpleasant, but you know, it's not a huge deal. But in people with underlying health conditions, they can get very seriously ill and hospitalised, as we're seeing at the moment. And I think it's just not necessarily obvious to people that this is such a problem, I think.
Just on the effect, if you like, on the health system, if the numbers of people developing flu rise during the course of the Christmas season, given that the numbers are already so much higher, what is the knock-on effect of other services for people who haven't got flu?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the more beds that are taken up by patients with flu, then the less beds there are for other people who are seriously ill, and that presents a problem. And, you know, that's the reason for persuading people who have these underlying health conditions to get vaccinated, to indeed protect our health service from these kind of problems.
Is part of the issue, aside from the online kind of debate over vaccination and some of the myths which we were talking about earlier, and we've heard, for example, in the online campaign to encourage people to vaccination, is it also that perhaps we've lost our sense of fear about flu, not least because COVID came along to give us something to fear even more?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that there. I think we did assume that COVID was bad, and COVID was really bad in some people. And I think people have just forgotten that flu is nasty and can be equally as nasty in particular categories of people. And I think that is part of the problem. And there's probably also an element of vaccine fatigue as well, I think.
Any impact from some of the kind of practices that we adopted during COVID?
I think perhaps that's sort of more past now than it was. Certainly, you know, in the last year for sure, we saw a much higher rise of flu and various other viruses because we hadn't been exposed to them all the time like we were, because during COVID we were all shut away from each other. So where flu would normally circulate and we'd all have this sort of rumbling low immunity, we'd had a year or two without it. But I think probably now at this point, because we certainly had a reasonable amount of flu around last year, that's probably less of a problem perhaps than it was a year or two ago.
Do you think the health service needs to rethink the way it communicates? I mean, in the light of the debate over vaccination, which online has become so poisonous in some places, that it perhaps has to kind of redirect its energies. I mean, there's been a confident assumption for years that, well, everybody knows vaccination is a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think our messaging here needs to be clearer, particularly to people at risk, and to be reminded of the risk of flu and how bad it is, and to understand the importance of vaccination. And I agree with you completely. I think that's a message now we perhaps need to review exactly how we get that across.
Professor Claire Bryan, Professor of Innate Immunity at Cambridge University, thanks very much for joining us. Approaching 4 years since the military coup in Myanmar, which removed its elected government and returned Aung San Suu Kyi, globally the country's best-known political figure, to house arrest, a BBC investigation has found that the regime now fully controls less than a quarter of the country. Resistance to the coup, as well as the country's history of ethnic strife, has contributed to a patchwork of opposition groups and ethnic armies. Between them, these fully control more than 40% of Myanmar. For over a year, BBCI has been following one of these rebel units, and as Rebecca Henschke's report reveals now, they're being helped by spies inside the military.
In a jungle camp near the Thai-Myanmar border, pro-democracy rebel commander Dewa watches over his troops' training.
We rallied peacefully on the streets. They cracked down on us, so we tried to protect ourselves. Later, we thought armed struggle was the only way to counter those who were wielding weapons. That's why we fought back.
He's got a thin physique and wears studious glasses. Definitely doesn't look like the image of a rebel fighter. Yet he's one of the most wanted men in Myanmar.
Around the campfire, they sing a song called Stars, about fallen comrades. They sing, "We lived in fear for generations. Now is the time to fight." Later, Dewa lies in a hammock under some trees at the side of their makeshift camp and picks up his phone.
Hello.
One of his key weapons in the war. He's talking to a spy, a soldier in the Yangon region. They're known as watermelons, green on the outside, appearing to be loyal to the regime, but inside red, working for the pro-democracy uprising.
Watermelons are vital. Through them, we know the enemy's positions, movements, strengths, and plans. And we prepare our military operations using that.
As well as ordinary troops, Dewa also controls underground cells in Yangon that are carrying out targeted attacks against the regime. He makes another call. This time, it's to one of his cells in Yangon. We're not given the details, but it's clear they're planning an assassination.
We will do it inside the enemy's security perimeters. The target is a colonel.
While the underground cell makes plans, Dewa is moving his ground unit. He's received a tip-off from a watermelon about a security post near a strategically located bridge.
We have been told about their capabilities, where their reinforcements will come from, and which route they will use to withdraw.
Dewa deploys his men on the opposite side of the bridge over a fast-flowing river. Sandbags are put in place, and snipers position themselves. "Come quickly and join the people. You have no way to escape," they yell. At night, on the 10th day, they make a final push, using a drone to target the security post. It goes up in flames. They claim to have killed more than 30 soldiers. The regime are aggressively trying to reclaim lost territory, and are carrying out sweeps looking for watermelons. If caught, they would likely be killed. But this frontline watermelon says it's worth the risk. For security reasons, his words are being voiced by an actor.
We are meant to protect civilians, but now we are killing our people. It's no longer an army. It's a force that is terrorizing our people. I've witnessed military intelligence killing innocent people. I'm angry. My anger is bigger than my fear.
That report from Myanmar was by Rebecca Henschke. The Myanmar military did not respond to the BBC's request for an interview. You can hear the full investigation. It's titled The Watermelons, and it's available in the documentary podcast feed on BBC Sounds. Now, following the conviction of Gisèle Pelicot's ex-husband yesterday, jailed for 20 years for orchestrating and taking part in her rape with dozens of strangers, Jane Hill spoke to Bénédicte Martin and Joanna Robinson, two women survivors of sex attacks, here on The World Tonight. During the discussion, Bénédicte said French men she knew of hadn't been talking about the case and what it meant for men. So we approached a Frenchman who's been doing just that. Ivan Jablonka's bestseller about masculinity was translated into English as A History of Masculinity from Patriarchy to Gender Justice. When we spoke this evening, I asked him first about what could be said of the attitudes of men in France to this terrible case.
I would say that many of them try to escape the challenges of Me Too by minimizing, denying, remaining silent, or just, you know, looking the other way. In my view, this trial will mark French history because it prompted discussions about rape culture and toxic masculinity, even among men. This trial is historic by the number of defendants, by the horrible, obnoxious nature of the facts, and also by the courage to have accepted public debates. In my view, this trial will mark French history, and it already has the same importance as the ex-trial that took place in 1978. At that time, the ex-trial defined in precise terms the very notion of a rape.
You talked earlier in your answer about the risk that men simply turn away and don't see the treatment that women are experiencing. That is the most extreme example of looking away. These men, their excuse was they thought it was a consensual sexual act, even though she was clearly unconscious. And that gets to the heart of part of the gender debate in this, doesn't it? And I just wonder if you have a view on how French men are reacting to that.
I cannot answer this question because it would need, you know, a sociological survey. What can I say is that during 3 months of lengthy hearings, the defendants appeared on a parade. Many said they had been trapped. So I don't feel the defendants really understood what they were being accused of.
And no one has yet conducted surveys of men's opinion on this case. I'm fascinated that in a country with as lively a media as France, that there hasn't been some attempt to measure male reaction.
Not in my knowledge. And I would say that some men did pay attention to the trial, but others remained silent, or some of them stated that this was a kind of gray zone, you know. In my view, the gray zone is not a valid concept or notion. It's only a sign of a social and emotional immaturity when it comes to intimate relationships. But as for the defendants, I would like to add that there were at least two questions they should have addressed. First of all, how could men penetrate the inert body of a woman who hadn't been able to give her consent? And the second question is, how could these men believe to be authorized by the husband to rape his wife? Some of them said you know, the husband was okay. So for me, it was a kind of clearance.
And that, in a sense, is the kind of epitome of a patriarchal system, isn't it? That you treat the woman as if she is the property or chattel of the husband.
Exactly. I totally agree with you. This is the very definition of what patriarchy is, the right of men over women's bodies. Sometimes when I discuss with young or old men around me, they say, you know, patriarchy is a very old stuff. It no longer exists. But you know that what the defendants did is the very definition of patriarchal conception.
The French writer and historian Ivan Jablonka. It's the longest night of the year, but at least that means we can look forward to the days beginning to get longer again. For those countries that were part of ancient Persia, including Iran, the winter solstice is celebrated as Yalda night. It's a great excuse for an all-nighter as well, because friends and family often stay up in order to welcome the arrival of the sun the next morning. Dominic Parviz-Brookshaw is Professor of Persian Literature and Iranian Culture at the University of Oxford. Professor Brookshaw, thanks for being with us on The World Tonight. And I should say, I don't know if this is appropriate, but happy Yalda night to you.
Thank you very much. Yes, it is appropriate.
Tell us what it means, the significance to people from the old Persian Empire and the modern countries that occupy that same territory today.
Well, as you said, it's a celebration marking the longest night of the year and the coming of longer days. So it's a hopeful moment in the year. Yalda comes from Syriac and means the birth, and perhaps it means the birth of the sun, the birth of light, or the birth of Mithra. So it has an ancient pre-Islamic origin to it, but it's a very popular celebration nowadays.
And diet, as always, food is important to how you celebrate any festivity. What have you been eating, or what will you be eating?
So Iranians love to eat, and fruit is a really important part of Iranian food culture. And on Yalda night, we eat pomegranates, we eat watermelon, persimmons, but also dried fruits and nuts. And then quite often people will make special foods. So one of the foods that we make in our family is fesenjun, and I've made it tonight, which is a stew of walnuts, pomegranate, and either duck or chicken.
You know, I knew we should have dragged you into the studio. It's a shame we're going to miss out on that, but I'm sure those who are with you will enjoy it. It sounds very tempting. Poetry is also a big part of this.
Yes.
And I think you have a little bit of poetry you'd like to share with us this evening.
I do. I have two lines from the poet that is read specifically on Shabi Yalda, who is the 14th century poet Hafez. So I'll read it in Persian, then give you a translation. چرا نه در پی عزم دیار خود باشم؟ چرا نه خاک سر کوی یار خود باشم؟ غم غریبی و غربت چو بر نمیتابم به شهر خود روم و شهریار خود باشم. Why should I not seek to set out for my own hometown? Why should I not be the dust at the end of my beloved's lane? When I cannot bear the sorrow of alienation and nostalgic longing, I should return to my own city and become my own king.
That's a beautiful note on which to end there. Professor Dominic Parviz-Brookshaw at the University of Oxford, have a lovely evening. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Closing headlines. A car has been driven into crowds at a Christmas market in the German city of Magdeburg, killing two people, one of them a young child. As many as 70 others were injured. A 50-year-old man originally from Saudi Arabia has been arrested. He's said to be a doctor who'd been in Germany since 2006. The suspect who drove a car into crowds acted alone, according to the state prime minister of Saxony-Anhalt. That's The World Tonight. I'm Sean Lay for now. From me and everybody on the programme this week, good night and have a good weekend.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.